With exchange rates floating, the perceived risk of such transactions rose sharply. Thus, unexpected economic shocks should be more easily absorbed than a decade ago. But can trade and standards of living continue to increase indefinitely? Yes. That is the gift of competitive free markets and the irreversible accumulation of technology. The volume of cross-border trade has few national limits. For any country, exports less imports cannot be greater than GDP less inventory change, and for the world as a whole, exports equal imports, but there is no limit to gross flows. Luxembourg's exports, for example, were 177% of GDP in 2006, and its imports 149%. Nonetheless, after the major opening up of world markets, especially following the demise of the Soviet Union, many barriers and inefficiencies have already been removed. In a sense, most of the low-hanging fruit of trade openings has already been picked. Certainly, the inability to complete the Doha round of trade negotiations in 2006 should give us all pause regarding the future pace of global enhancement of the world's living standards. The rate of decline in trade barriers is almost surely going to slow as we reach the point of intractable political resistance to further lowering. This suggests that the growth of export-oriented economies, such as those of East Asia, is not likely to be as rapid as that of the last six decades. Eventually, the convergence, or at least the reduction, of risk-adjusted spreads of cost among competitors of internationally traded goods, manufacturers, and commodities will diminish the effectiveness of export-oriented growth strategies. And while service export-oriented growth policies are very visible, for example, India exporting call center and computer services to the United States, the process known in the United States as outsourcing, such markets are still very small. One impediment to ever-rising export shares of China and the Tigers is their rising costs of production. In one of the great ironies of the post-war years, Vietnam is now being sought as the next production platform for expanding market-based, read capitalist, trade. Under the U.S.-Vietnam Bilateral Trade Agreement of 2001, Vietnamese exports to the United States increased eightfold from $1.1 billion in 2001 to $9.3 billion in 2006. U.S. exports to Vietnam more than doubled. U.S. history after World War II chronicles two military defeats in our war to contain communism. The first was the rapid retreat of U.S. forces in the face of masses of Chinese military crossing the Yalu River into North Korea in the winter of 1950. The second, our humiliation in abandoning South Vietnam in 1975. We may have lost the battles, but not the war. Both Communist China and Communist Vietnam have been struggling to loosen their central planning straitjackets for the economic freedom of capitalism while trying not to say out loud what they are doing. In 2006, America's Merrill Lynch, following Citigroup a year earlier, obtained the right to buy, sell, and market Vietnamese shares on Ho Chi Minh City's fledgling stock exchange. When Bill Gates, the world's richest capitalist, visited Hanoi, he was greeted by Vietnam's top Communist Party leaders and mobbed in admiration. Will miracles never cease? Ideas do matter. Indeed, America's capitalistic ideas appeared mightier than our sword. Perhaps more than any of the other major countries addressed in this book, India symbolizes most powerfully both the productiveness of market capitalism and the stagnation of socialism. India is fast becoming two entities, a rising kernel of world-class modernity within a historic culture that has been for the most part stagnating for generations. This kernel of modernity appears to have largely leapfrogged the 20th century labor-intensive manufacturing for export model embraced by China and the rest of East Asia. India has focused instead on 21st century high-tech global services, the most rapidly growing segment of world economic activity. The spark of modernity has triggered advances in the whole Indian service sector, including trade, tourism, and tourism-related construction. The pickup in real GDP growth from 3.5% between 1950 and 1980 to 9% in 2006 has been truly remarkable. These advances have elevated more than 250 million people out of the extreme subsistence poverty incomes of less than $1 per day. Yet India's per capita GDP, which was at parity with China's in the early 1990s, is now only two-fifths that of China. In fact, at $730 per person, it is below the per capita GDP of Côte d'Ivoire and Lesotho. The reason for India's failure to follow China off the lower rungs of developing nations over the past 15 years is an idea. When Britain declared Indian independence in 1947, it withdrew all aspects of British governing, but left behind a concept that captivated India's elite, Fabian socialism. Jawaharlal Nehru, a disciple of the revered Mahatma Gandhi, an Indian prime minister for 16 years following independence, was firmly attracted by the rationality of the Fabians, and he perceived market competition as economically destructive. Because of him, socialism has retained a firm grip on Indian economic policy long after it was abandoned by Britain. Nehru was entranced by central planning as the rational extension of human beings acting in concert to produce material well-being for the many rather than the few. As prime minister, he initially focused on state ownership of strategic industries, mainly electric power and heavy industry, while imposing significant controls on all else, administered by a cadre of knowledgeable, ostensibly benevolent government officials. Soon, these ubiquitous controls, the License Raj, as they came to be called, had infiltrated virtually all Indian economic activity. You needed a license, permit, or stamp for seemingly every conceivable economic action. Thus constrained, India settled into a placid rate of growth that came to be known derisively as the Hindu 3%. The bureaucracy did not know what to do. Its scientific system was supposed to elevate growth. It didn't. Yet to abolish controls would be to abandon the egalitarian principles of Fabian socialism. Since the plethora of licenses, permits, and stamps didn't seem to help the economy, in fact, they were stifling it, what decisions the bureaucracy made on granting permits soon lost all higher purpose and became arbitrary. But, as I noted in describing the Chinese Communist Party's pyramid of authority, discretion is power. Even the most principled Indian civil servants were reluctant to cede it, and the less principled had something to sell. No wonder India was, and is, rated poorly in every measure of corruption. Thus, a bureaucracy encompassing most every segment of the Indian economy was in firm control and ceded power only reluctantly. That reluctance was reinforced and supported by India's powerful and entrenched labor unions, and particularly by the communist parties that have always been prominent in Indian politics. Socialism not only is a form of economic organization, but also, because of its fundamental premise of collective ownership, has profoundly important cultural implications, most of which have been embraced by a majority of Indians. India is impressively the world's largest democracy. Democracy elects people who represent the population, and in India's case, it, as it should, has continued to favor significantly those who believe in the collective principles of socialism. The notion that government intellectuals, driven by the good of society overall, can far better determine the appropriate allocation of resources than can erratic free market forces dies hard in India. In June 1991, an old-line functionary, P.V. Narasimha Rao, of the leftist Congress Party, became prime minister. The economy was teetering on the edge of collapse, reflecting more than four decades of de facto central planning. Now, as it was becoming evident that India was suffering from the same failed paradigm that had blighted Eastern Europe, a major change was in the offing. To everyone's surprise, Rao broke with long-standing tradition and, as a balance of payments crisis loomed, moved to eliminate aspects of the deadening hand of controls. He appointed Manmohan Singh finance minister. Singh, a market-oriented economist, was able to tear a modest hole in the regimented economy. He initiated liberalizing steps in a wide range of areas and demonstrated once again that a little economic freedom and competition can exert extraordinary leverage on economic growth. The anti-capitalist voices were temporarily stilled by the gravity of the crisis, which created a window of opportunity for deregulation. Market capitalism was able to gain a foothold and demonstrate its effectiveness. Much of recent global economic history is the story of the centrally planned states of Eastern Europe and China adopting market competition and being rewarded with a rapid increase in economic growth. India's is not quite that story. To be sure, Singh introduced much reform, but in many critical areas he was constrained by the enduring socialist inclinations of his governmental coalition. Even today, firms with more than 100 employees, with few exceptions, cannot fire anyone without government permission. The reforms initiated by Singh in 1991 are still unfolding. Somewhat lowered tariff barriers have freed entrepreneurs to participate in international competitive markets. Nonetheless, India's tariffs are still double the average levels for Southeast Asian countries, increasing the costs of materials consumed in production for export. India still comprises only 2.5% of global trade in goods and services. China accounts for 10.5%. Both exports and imports of goods have risen sharply relative to nominal GDP, and net software exports went up from $5.8 billion in 2001 to $22.3 billion in 2006. Of course, Indian exporters still have to contend with red tape at home, but for them, property rights protection and price and cost determination are now largely beyond the bureaucracy's reach. Property rights in India are significantly undermined by the cost of enforcing a contract. According to the World Bank, it takes 425 to 1,165 days, depending on the state, to enforce a contract in Indian courts. 9/10 of land in India is subject to disputes over ownership. The liberalizations of Singh, combined with the fall in global communications costs, educated Indians' English language skills, and low wages, propelled India into the forefront of internationally outsourced business services, call centers, software engineering, insurance claim processing, mortgage lending, accounting, X-ray scan evaluations, and an ever-widening spread of internet-based services. Indian software engineers helped the world rise to the Y2K challenge. The image of India as a major provider of outsourcing was particularly evident to Americans, who exaggeratedly viewed India as cutting a wide swath through skilled U.S. white-collar jobs. But India's competitive incursion has been modest to small, especially in proportion to its workforce of nearly 450 million. Total employment in India's information technology industry is currently about 1.5 million, five times its level of 1999. Almost all the increase is export-related. Another 3 million jobs have apparently been created in telecommunications, power, and construction as a consequence of the IT surge. Directly and indirectly, that's barely 1% of total employment in India. And that's the problem. The IT industry and other services isolated in the major cities of Bangalore, Delhi, and Mumbai have vaulted over the 20th century into the 21st. But as a government official complained to a BBC interviewer in early 2007, "Go out beyond the glitter of some of the cities, and you are back in the 19th century." For India to become the major player in the international arena that it aspires to be, it will need to build factories that entice a very large part of its agricultural workers to urban enclaves to produce labor-intensive exports, the time-honored path of the successful Asian tigers and China. Manufacturing in India, however, even high-tech, has been hobbled for decades by job-destroying labor laws, a decrepit infrastructure that cannot provide reliable electric power, and roads and rails that inhibit movement of manufactured parts and finished products between plants and markets. Many business establishments have installed their own small generators to ensure power. Owing to costly labor laws that apply to establishments of 10 or more employees, more than 40% of employment in all manufacturing takes place in firms employing 5 to 9 workers. This compares with only 4% in Korea. Productivity in these small Indian firms is 20% or less of that of large firms. The small firms evidently can't create the economies of scale available to the larger firms. If mass manufacturing is ever to close the gap in standards of living between India and China, the rival to which it is so often compared, India will need to encourage agricultural labor to migrate to the manufacturing sector in the cities. And to encourage workers tied to the land to leave, manufacturing will have to become globally competitive. That will require a major scrapping of the remaining parts of the license raj. In play is the fate of the 3/5 of the Indian workforce who toil inefficiently on farms. They need a dramatic change for the better. Rural India is mired in a level of poverty as bleak as anywhere in the world outside of sub-Saharan Africa. Here is where a high concentration of India's illiterate, two-fifths of the adult population, and most of the more than 250 million Indians who live on less than $1 a day reside. Half of India's homes have no electricity. Productivity on farms is only one-fourth of what it is in non-farm areas. Rice yields are half of what they are in Vietnam and a third of what they are in China. India's cotton's comparative yields are even worse. Wheat yields, which so benefited from the enhanced seed of the Green Revolution of the 1970s, are still only three-fourths of China's. Only in tea is India more productive than its Asian competitors. Moreover, Indian road transport linking farms and cities is so inadequate that output of perishable crops is largely restricted to on-farm consumption. A third of crops is reported to rot en route to market. Growth of agricultural productivity has slowed since the 1980s. Although weather has been partly to blame, a highly subsidized government-directed agriculture that prevents market forces from adjusting acreage usage is the main culprit. The government in recent years has expended more than 4% of GDP on subsidies, mainly on food and fertilizer, while state subsidization of power and irrigation has added measurably more. If farm workers are encouraged to migrate to the more productive cities, as has happened in China, a level of agricultural output that feeds 1.1 billion people must be maintained. India's ability to expand food imports is limited. Farm productivity growth is thus the only viable way to maintain food availability as manufacturing draws workers from rural India. Market competition in agriculture is badly needed. Martin Feldstein, the eminent Harvard economist, in a somewhat different context, stressed an irony that is applicable to India's farm policy dilemma in an essay in the Wall Street Journal, February 16, 2006. Cell phone service is widely available in India at low cost because it was regarded as a luxury and therefore left to the market, while electricity is hard to obtain because it has been regarded as a necessity and therefore managed by the government. Regrettably, the dismantling of large farm subsidies seems no more likely in Delhi than it does in Paris or Washington. Long-term subsidies are capitalized in the value of the land. The net beneficiaries of subsidies are always those who own land when the subsidies are created. Future owners pay for the expected continued subsidy flow in an elevated purchase price of the land. They are not, in principle, net beneficiaries. To increase taxes on farmlands, which, in effect, is what an uncompensated reduction in subsidies does, is not taken lightly by farm owners. Some progress in trimming these subsidies has been accomplished on the edges, but a frontal assault will be difficult, considering the leanings of the Congress Party and its 23 coalition partners, including the Communists. Prime Minister Singh is a highly reputable, reform-oriented economist, but he does not have the authoritarian clout that enabled Deng Xiaoping to start China's agricultural reform in 1978. Indian democracy is up to this task. It needs only to focus on the urgent needs of India's population. A very large dose of deregulation and competition can spread India's IT revolution to the rest of the country. Growth in India's industrial production has accelerated since 2004, but the nation still lags behind China's growth in services and especially industrial production. India's rapidly growing IT sector is largely the result of homegrown software programmers and engineers. While Indian entrepreneurs are doing exceptionally well in high-tech service, they are doing less well with high-tech hardware, which suffers many of the shortcomings of Indian manufacturing overall. The manufacturing for export model that India urgently needs to embrace has an impressive record of success elsewhere in Asia. It is a model that employs in mass urban manufacturing centers low-wage rural workers with some education. A critical ingredient has been foreign direct investment, FDI, embodying advanced technologies and attracted by laws, often newly drawn, protecting property rights. With the demise of central planning, this model has spread across the developing world, especially China. But clearly the license Raj has discouraged foreign direct investment. India received $7 billion in FDI in 2005, a sum dwarfed by China's $72 billion. India's cumulative stock of FDI at 6% of GDP at the end of 2005 compares with 9% for Pakistan, 14% for China, and 61% for Vietnam. The reason FDI has lagged badly in India is perhaps no better illustrated than by India's unwillingness to fully embrace market forces. That is all too evident in India's often statist response to economic problems. Faced with rising food inflation in early 2007, the response was not to allow rising prices to prompt an increase in supply, but to ban wheat exports for the rest of the year and suspend futures trading to curb speculation. The very market forces that the Indian economy needs to break the stranglehold of bureaucracy. Chapter 16. Russia's Sharp Elbows. To say I was startled doesn't do the moment justice. Vladimir Putin's chief economic advisor, Andrei Ilarionov, approached me after a U.S.-Russia bilateral meeting at the International Monetary Fund in October 2004 and asked, "The next time you are in Moscow, would you be willing to meet with me and some of my friends to discuss Ayn Rand?" For Rand, the uncompromising defender of laissez-faire capitalism and fiery foe of communism, to have penetrated the cloistered enclave of Russian intellectual leadership was to me mind-boggling. Putin certainly must have been familiar with Ilarionov's staunch defense of free competitive markets when he hired him. Was Ilarionov thus a window into the policy inclinations of Putin? Was the culture under which all Russians were raised being shed that quickly? It seemed incredible that Putin, this former member of the KGB, could have developed so un-Soviet a perspective in so short a time. The reality, obviously, is far more complex. When Putin was appointed acting president by Boris Yeltsin at the end of 1999, he capped an astonishing rise through the ranks that had started only 4 years earlier when he began working in Moscow as a presidential advisor. He was named deputy head of presidential administration in 1997 and came to the attention of the world in 1998 when, as head of the Federal Security Service, he ordered Russian troops into Chechnya. His presidency was embraced by reformers who felt confident he would promote continued evolution to a market economy. From the start, Putin expressed support for such reforms, although he argued that they must work in concert with Russia's realities, including the tradition of a paternalistic state. Within 2 years, Putin, along with Ilarionov, pushed through the Duma an aggressive agenda of tax reform, deregulation, and some privatization of land, with the clear goal of steering Russia into the global economy. But after this promising embrace of capitalism, Putin began to backtrack toward authoritarianism. Apparently, he feared that Russia would become subject to market forces over which he had no control. In particular, the oligarchs, business opportunists who had laid claim to much of Russia's productive wealth through special loans for shares deals with the Kremlin during the 1990s, were seen as using their riches to subvert his regime. As a consequence, starting in 2003, a different economic strategy began to emerge. Through selective enforcement of new and existing laws, Putin wrenched control of myriad energy assets back into the Kremlin's orbit. The key driver of Russian economic growth, oil and gas, is becoming increasingly nationalized in Russian government-owned or government-controlled monopolies like Gazprom, which dominates natural gas, and Rosneft, which dominates oil. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the founder of Yukos Oil, was jailed and stripped of his assets, which Rosneft then swallowed. I do not pretend to know whether Khodorkovsky was guilty of the crimes with which he was charged, but the stark shift from the Kremlin's earlier market liberalism clearly disillusioned Ilarionov, and he was soon publicly criticizing his boss. He openly called the retroactive tax claim on Yukos assets and the scarcely hidden financial manipulations in favor of Rosneft the swindle of the year. Given Putin's KGB roots and his upbringing in a collectivized society, it is unlikely that he has a deep understanding of how free markets work. But his choice of Ilarionov as chief economic advisor had to mean he had been attracted by the evident successes of capitalism in fostering high standards of living. Ultimately, however, Putin may have found himself more threatened by the seeming anarchy of Yeltsin's capitalism than inspired by the stabilizing force of Adam Smith's invisible hand. Then again, I doubt that Adam Smith was the primary issue on Putin's mind. His seizure of Russia's oil and gas wealth and his ham-handed cutoff of natural gas to Ukraine and Western Europe for 2 days in January 2006 were most likely aimed at restoring Russia's international relevance. What is remarkable in all this is that it took so long for Ilarionov to be demoted. Eventually, he was relieved of his role as presidential representative to the G8 heads of government, and in 2005 he resigned, stating that Russia was no longer a free country. But Ilarionov's extended Kremlin tenure may reflect a grudging attraction by Putin to the capitalist paradigm. Putin's ambivalence about retreating fully from Yeltsin's democracy surfaced in a revealing exchange with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, who described it in a 2006 radio interview. Gorbachev quoted President Putin as saying that the influence of mafia groups and other such elements is so strong that elections become buyer-seller situations. This was bad, Gorbachev said Putin told him, because you can't have democracy and fight crime and corruption if criminal elements are able to infiltrate the ranks of the government in such a way. In the same March 1, 2006 interview, Gorbachev said, as a country in transition, it is inevitable that some freedoms are impinged on and that some mistakes are made. But I am convinced that our president is not trying to install any sort of authoritarian rule. Ironically, he made these remarks on Radio Free Europe, the American broadcasting system created to counter Soviet propaganda. He added in an August 18, 2006 interview, also on Radio Free Europe, there are frequent accusations that democracy is being suppressed and that freedom of the press is being stifled. The truth is, most Russians disagree with this viewpoint. We find ourselves at a difficult historical juncture. Our transition to democracy has not been a smooth one. When Putin first came to power, I think his first priority was keeping the country from falling apart, and this required certain measures that wouldn't exactly be referred to as textbook democracy. Yes, there are certain worrying anti-democratic tendencies. However, I would not dramatize the situation. Is Putin a man who would be drawn to democracy if crime and corruption were largely eliminated? Or is he just an effective debater on the side of authoritarianism? Gorbachev seems to believe the former. Certainly, a significant part of the Russian economy under Putin continues to throw off the shackles of Soviet central planning, an indication of an acceptance of greater freedoms. A glaring exception is Russia's natural gas monopoly, Gazprom, created in 1992. Its pricing and its rationing of supplies are reminiscent of Soviet central planning opaqueness and inefficiencies. Its huge pipeline infrastructure, as a consequence, is not fully maintained and is aging. Putin behaves as though he believes free markets are fine for most of Russia's economy. But he likely also believes that de facto state control of major energy assets would prevent continued exploitation of Russia's economic crown jewels by the oligarchs. Those crown jewels, of course, have become immensely more valuable as oil and gas prices have risen to several times their 1998 levels. No longer bolstered by the Soviet Union's Cold War military prestige, Russia at the beginning of the 21st century found itself relegated to being a distinctly lesser player on the world scene. Ukraine, Georgia, and other former Soviet republics had drifted out of Russia's orbit and control. To address that, Putin may be strategically employing an asset that in many ways is more potent than the Red Army, a huge presence in world energy markets. The USSR's military was restrained by potential U.S. counteraction. But Russia does not see itself threatened with massive retaliation should it use natural gas as an economic or political weapon. Because Russia is a critical supplier of gas to Western Europe and to so-called near-abroads like Ukraine, its market power is largely uncontested. In addition, Russia has also become a major player in the world crude oil market, although its leverage there is weaker than in the market for natural gas because oil cannot be monopolized as easily. I suspect Putin was puzzled by the West's reaction to his management of the negotiation over Gazprom's request for higher prices for natural gas in Ukraine. He was roundly denounced for Soviet-style bullying when his intervention resulted in a brief shutoff of supplies. But, he must have wondered, aren't capitalists supposed to charge what the market will bear and not hesitate to exploit economic advantage for profit? Besides, he was merely removing the subsidy Ukraine had been getting from Russia for years. The related shortfall in delivery of gas to Western Europe was inadvertent. Wouldn't 19th-century America's Vanderbilt or Carnegie have behaved this way? I think not. True capitalists protecting their long-term profitability would have sought a gradual adjustment in the name of good customer relations and maximum long-term profitability. While it appears that, since the gas shutdown, Ukraine has become more accepting of Russian near-abroad policies, the incident has prompted customers in Western Europe to seek alternatives to Russian gas, especially liquefied natural gas and other piped sources. That will not serve Russia's long-term interests. But in the short run, Putin's gas and oil policy has succeeded impressively. Less than two decades after its fall as the leader of the Soviet behemoth, Russia has regained a full measure of global attention. And while Putin has gradually dismantled significant parts of the democracy that evolved under Yeltsin, I'd like to believe that, as Mikhail Gorbachev said in August 2006, Russia has changed to such an extent that going back now is impossible. There is no denying that Putin has selectively encouraged market openings and has initiated significant improvements in the rule of law. He has supported drastic revisions of the remnants of the collectivized Soviet legal system. The role of judges in the Russian courts, which were notoriously corrupt, has been redefined to reduce opportunities for bribery and the political manipulation of verdicts. For instance, laws promulgated in 2001 removed many economically meaningless requirements for businesses to obtain licenses, inspections, and product certifications, red tape that had been an open-ended invitation for official corruption. Low-wage bureaucratic jobs were thus in great demand. Property rights have been extended in recent years, though struggles over rights to buy and sell farmland reflect much the same communist ideological hangover that exists in China. Except to challenge the power of the Kremlin, the Russian people are free to travel, to congregate, and to engage in all the trappings of democratic societies. The Russian economy is today best described as a market economy backed by a still imperfect rule of law. A significant segment of the nation's most valued assets is in the hands of the state or of Kremlin allies. Political control has been reinforced through control of the major media operations, with most of the remainder encouraged to censor themselves. Putin and his policies remain immensely popular. Objections from the Russian public are few. Apparently, the chaos of Yeltsin's democracy, including financial defaults that savaged people's savings, left a residue of profound discomfort. A poll in 2006 reported that almost half of the Russian people value material well-being over freedom and human rights. Democracy and freedom of speech are not high priorities. Given a choice between the democratic freedoms and economic instability of the Yeltsin years and the stability and authoritarianism that have emerged under Putin, for now, most Russians prefer Putin. This saddens me, but I am not surprised. Perhaps we in the West were too sanguine in expecting a radical reversal in people who for more than seven decades had been indoctrinated in collectivism. As Gorbachev once wrote in the Financial Times, July 12, 2006, the economies of the major Western countries took many decades, indeed centuries, to develop and mature. Russia is still less than 20 years on from a totalitarian state based on central planning, and our path to reform requires a little longer, even for us. But history suggests that just as Russians rebelled against the chaos of the 1990s, so too will they tire of restrictions on political freedom. Human nature in this regard is highly predictable. A reaction is not a question of whether, but when. Since its collapse into bankruptcy in 1998, Russia's economy has recovered beyond most every analyst's expectations. Real per capita GDP has moved well above the pre-crisis level. The unemployment rate, hovering around 13% in 1998, declined to less than 7% by early 2007. The inflation rate has fallen to single digits from a 12-month peak of 127% in July 1999, and Russia's foreign exchange holdings rose from $8 billion at the end of 1999 to nearly $300 billion by 2007. The government's foreign debt has been paid down substantially. Most of the credit for this sterling economic performance, of course, goes to the dramatic surge in the prices of oil and natural gas. Growth in the value of oil and gas exports accounted for a fifth of the growth in nominal GDP between 1998 and 2006. However, few natural resource bonanzas arrive without a Faustian bargain. Russia's economic policymakers are confronted with a daunting dilemma. A faster rise in the ruble exchange rate will foster the spread of Dutch disease, but foreign asset purchases to slow the rising foreign exchange value of the ruble may uncork inflation, depending on the mechanism used. Either would undo much of the economic progress Russia has made since the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Dutch disease symptoms are already evident. As oil and gas exports surged, the value of the ruble rose and the value of Russian non-commodity exports lagged. Between 1998 and 2006, the value of the ruble relative to the currencies of Russia's trading partners doubled after adjusting for their relative inflation rates. The impact was predictable. Exports excluding oil and gas went up only half as fast in real terms as oil and gas exports. Fully cognizant of the danger they face, and having watched Dutch disease cripple the economies of many OPEC oil producers, the Russians are in a battle to counter its effects. The standard treatment for Dutch disease is to buy foreign currencies with the country's domestic currency and thereby attempt to fight the market-driven rise in the country's exchange rate. The hope is to avoid, or at least mitigate, the negative competitive effects of the higher exchange rate on domestically produced goods. In the case of Russia, the central bank uses rubles in vast quantities to buy dollars or euros. But this increases the monetary base, the raw material of money supply creation, and risks inflation. Between 1998 and the end of 2006, the money supply, currency plus bank deposits, rose at a 45% annual rate. Unit money supply, that is, money supply divided by output, rose at a 35% annual rate. Over the long run, the general price level tends to track unit money supply, since prices are defined in terms of money, for example, $4 per bushel of wheat. In simple terms, the more money outstanding to purchase the flow of produced goods and services, the higher the average price. That even the relatively high Russian inflation rate of almost 10% a year has been running far short of the rate of increase in unit money supply is doubtless puzzling and worrying to Russian monetary authorities who fear a resurgence of inflation. Of course, the Central Bank of Russia, like all central banks, has the ability to destroy as well as create money. It does so by selling ruble-denominated debt to the public and then extinguishing the proceeds. But the CBR is limited by the lack of a broad ruble debt market and of a sophisticated banking system to facilitate debt sales, a heritage of these institutions' lowly status in the USSR. Without ready means of sopping up and destroying the excess rubles created by CBR purchases of dollars and other foreign currency, Russia would soon have to curtail its foreign currency purchases and allow the ruble to rise faster, triggering a Dutch disease relapse. Finance Minister Alexei Kudrin and his colleagues addressed this challenge starting in 2004. They have been designating a long-term nominal oil price, which, when exceeded, triggers the diversion of oil-related revenue from the Russian budget into a special fund administered by the Ministry of Finance. This so-called stabilization fund can be invested only in designated foreign assets, largely foreign government debt. Purchasing foreign assets directly with the budgeted excess oil revenues denominated in foreign currencies avoids increasing the monetary base and hence reduces the potential for inflation. By the spring of 2007, the fund had exceeded $117 billion, 97% of which was in foreign currencies, almost all in U.S. dollars and euros, roughly equally divided. For Russia's politicians, the downside of the stabilization fund is that it puts out of reach a great deal of cash. While it is true that government spending has risen significantly with the explosion of oil and gas-related revenues, Kudrin has succeeded, so far, in fending off pressure to feast on the oil bonanza. I had many occasions to meet with Kudrin when he appeared as a guest at G7 meetings of finance ministers and central bankers. He is very able, but I fear he is facing an uphill battle. It is unclear to me how much sway he has with Putin, other than on technical financial issues. Russia is still a developing nation whose oil and gas resources dominate its GDP. According to the World Bank, Russia's per capita gross national income in 2005 was below that of Mexico and about the same as Malaysia's. The ability to handle the stress of Dutch disease is obviously affected by the severity of the virus relative to the overall size of an economy. Yet why should Russia care if it has created an economy beholden to oil and gas? It is using some of its export revenues to import high-quality consumer goods from the rest of the world. Does it matter if those goods are produced at home or abroad? Indeed, it would not matter at all if oil and gas value added continued to grow as a consequence of ever-increasing output and/or ever-increasing prices. But oil and gas output is ultimately constrained by geology, and prices go down as well as up. Production from oil, and especially natural gas reservoirs, decays at a rate that requires a never-ending stream of new wells to keep production constant, not to mention rising. Without endless price increases, flat oil and gas output implies stagnant value added per worker. Oil and gas investment has slowed in recent years. A stagnant standard of living could result. To be sure, to counter that risk, the Russian government is using some of its oil and gas revenues to directly or indirectly finance acquisition of non-energy productive assets. The list is long: steel, aluminum, manganese, titanium, tankers, and aircraft. But these are largely technologies originally developed a century earlier. Moreover, these industries are poised to serve as national champions rather than profit-maximizing organizations. A Russian presence at the cutting edge of 21st century technologies has yet to be felt, although President Putin and his advisors announced ambitious plans in 2005 for special, albeit state-controlled, technology zones. The sharp fall in the value of the ruble following Russia's collapse into bankruptcy in 1998 forced the conversion of a grossly uncompetitive economy built up under generations of central planning into a marginally competitive one. With output per hour so low across Russia's vast territorial expanse, continuous shedding of grossly overmanned factories brought many industries to the margin of international competitiveness. Russia's substantial pent-up demand for consumer goods, combined with the possibilities of large foreign investment, would no doubt have propelled consumer goods output if only investors had been able to count on ownership rights. A markedly overvalued ruble, of course, would doubtless inhibit such investments. Despite defined codes, property rights in Russia remain tenuous. In recent years, the Duma has promulgated major pieces of legislation to support the rule of law, and the formal legal structure that rules today's Russia is a marked improvement over the black market economy of the early 1990s. It is one thing, however, to change the law. It is quite another to enforce the new rules. Putin used selective enforcement of new or existing statutes to take government control of energy assets. This selective enforcement, rather than any shortage of new rules, is the problem. There is little difference in legal certainty between a nation whose laws inhibit individual rights to property and one in which full legal rights are selectively enforced according to political priority. A right selectively enforced is not a right. Civilized societies have built up a vast set of cultural imperatives and conventions governing people's interactions with one another and the state. Very few are written down, and most of us are not fully aware of the extent to which societal forces, religion, and education direct even the minutest of our choices day by day. To be sure, our legal system is also based on these values, but of necessity in only general terms. Thus, a nation such as Russia may rewrite its legal code, but to reorder the cultural code is a task that will span years, if not generations. Consistent with Gorbachev's reports of his discussions with Putin, this may explain, but scarcely sanctions, the authoritarian thrust of recent Russian politics. In Russia, if the system is not working, you tighten the political reins by eliminating political pluralism and the messy democratic process that drives it. Stability and political calm are highly valued over the seeming chaos of highly competitive markets for goods and services or the democratic battles for political power. Capitalism, the engine of material well-being, thrives best with competitive politics. Authoritarian rule does not offer the necessary safety valve that in a capitalist society makes it possible to resolve disputes peacefully. The global economy, which must move forward if the world's standards of living are to continue to rise and poverty to retreat, requires capitalism's safety valve, democracy. Russia is destined to play a role in the further evolution of global capitalism. Whether that role will be limited by a slow-growing domestic economy sapped by Dutch disease and a suboptimal allocation of capital resources so typical of authoritarian regimes will be determined over the next couple of decades. Certainly to date, Russia appears to have weathered the Dutch disease more like a developed nation than like a developing one. So I would never count Russia out, As a graduate student, I was always impressed by the significant proportion of major mathematical insights footnoted with Russian names. Such a culture, I thought at the time, deserved a far more sophisticated economy than the Soviets were able to produce. Modern Russia has another shot at economic eminence. Much depends on whom Putin anoints as his successor. With its energy and military assets, Russia will be a major player on the world scene for decades ahead. Yet it is far too soon to conclude what type of player it will be. Chapter 17. Latin America and Populism. Pedro Malan, the finance minister of Brazil, sat across the table from me at a December 1999 meeting in Berlin. He was typical of the many highly competent Latin American economic policymakers who attended that first meeting of the Group of 20, an organization of finance ministers and central bank governors that had been put together after several tumultuous years in global finance. While we already knew one another, establishment of the group was seen as a way to help make sure that emerging market countries were fully involved in discussions of global economic developments. The G20 finance ministers and central bankers include the monetary authorities of the G7 nations, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, the United States, 12 other countries, Argentina, Australia, Brazil, China, India, Indonesia, Mexico, Russia, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, South Korea, Turkey, and the European Union. As central banker in 1994, Malan, under the leadership of Brazilian President Fernando Henrique Cardoso, was one of the architects of the Plano Real, which successfully brought the nation's roaring inflation to a halt after it had surged more than 5,000% during the 12 months between mid-1993 and mid-1994. I greatly admired Pedro, but I couldn't let go of a nagging question about the country. How could an economy be so mismanaged as to require so drastic a reform? Even Cardoso himself now says, "When the job fell to me, who in their right mind would have wanted to be president of Brazil?" More broadly, how did Latin America bolt from one economic crisis to another, and from civilian to military rule and back, in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s? The simple answer is that, with too few exceptions, Latin America had not been able to wean itself from the economic populism that had figuratively disarmed a whole continent in its competition with the rest of the world. I was particularly distressed by evidence that despite the indisputably bad economic outcomes of populist policies undertaken by almost all Latin American governments at one time or another since the end of World War II, these results had not seemed to dampen the impulse to resort to economic populism. Clearly, the 20th century was not kind to the United States' southern neighbors. According to the eminent economic historian Angus Madison, Argentina began the century with a real per capita GDP greater than that of Germany and almost three-fourths that of the United States. By the end of the century, however, Argentine per capita GDP had declined to half or less of those of Germany and the United States. Mexico's, during the century, fell from one-third to one-fourth of U.S. per capita GDP. These per capita GDPs are all reported in real terms. The economic pull of its northern neighbor was not enough to avert the slide. During the 20th century, the standards of living of the United States, Western Europe, and Asia each rose almost a third faster than those of Latin America. Only Africa and Eastern Europe did as poorly. The dictionary defines populism as a political philosophy that supports the rights and power of the people, usually in opposition to a privileged elite. I see economic populism as a response by an impoverished populace to a failing society, one characterized by an economic elite who are perceived as repressors. Under economic populism, the government accedes to the demands of the people, with little regard for either individual rights or the economic realities of how the wealth of a nation is increased or even sustained. In other words, the adverse economic consequences of the policies are ignored, willfully or inadvertently. Populism is most evident, as one would expect, in economies with high levels of income inequality, such as in Latin America. Indeed, inequality in all Latin American economies is among the highest in the world, far greater than in any industrial country, and, notably, higher than that of any of the economies of East Asia. The roots of Latin American inequality lie deep in the European colonization that, from the 16th through the 19th centuries, exploited slaves and indigenous populations. Its remnants today are to be seen, according to the World Bank, in large racial disparities in income. As a result, Latin America was fertile ground for the emergence of economic populism in the 20th century. Grinding poverty exists side by side with economic affluence. The economic elites are invariably accused of using the power of government to pad their own money belts. The United States is mistakenly perceived to this day to be a prime cause of economic misery south of its border. For decades, Latin politicians have railed against American corporate capitalism and Yankee imperialism. Particularly nettlesome to Latins has been a century of U.S. economic and military dominance and the use of gunboat diplomacy to assert American property rights. President Theodore Roosevelt in 1903 went a step further, abetting a revolt that detached Panama from Colombia after Colombia refused permission for the United States to build a canal through Panama. It is no wonder that Pancho Villa became a hero to Mexicans. Villa had been terrorizing American settlements on the border, and an extended U.S. military incursion into Mexico in 1916, led by General John Pershing, failed to apprehend him. The broader Latin response was best captured by Lázaro Cárdenas's act of defiant anti-Americanism that propelled him to become possibly the most popular Mexican president in the 20th century. In 1938, he expropriated all foreign-owned oil properties, mainly those of Standard Oil of New Jersey and Royal Dutch Shell. His action had dire long-term consequences for Mexico. Petróleos Mexicanos, Pemex, the government-owned oil monopoly successor to those foreign firms, is faltering. Unless the company obtains heretofore prohibited foreign assistance in deep-water drilling, its aged reserves will decline. Yet Cárdenas is remembered as a hero, and the family name, almost alone, fell just short of electing his son Cuauhtémoc to the presidency of Mexico in 1988. Since the end of World War II, indeed going back to Franklin Roosevelt's good neighbor policy, American foreign policy has made attempts to improve our negative image. Moreover, most objective analysts, I suspect, would credit post-war U.S. investment as an overall contributor to Latin America's prosperity. But history hangs heavy in the region. The beliefs that pass from one generation to another, a society's culture, change very slowly. Many 21st century Latin Americans, in my experience, continue to rail against the United States. Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, in particular, has worked assiduously to fan anti-American feelings. Economic populism seeks reform, not revolution. Its practitioners are clear about the specific grievances to be addressed, but its prescriptions are vague. Unlike capitalism or socialism, economic populism does not bring with it a formalized analysis of the conditions necessary for the creation of wealth and rising standards of living. It is far from cerebral. It is more a shout of pain. Populist leaders offer unequivocal promises to remedy perceived injustices. Redistribution of land and the prosecution of a corrupt elite who are allegedly stealing from the impoverished are common cure-alls. The leaders promise land, housing, and food for everyone. Justice is also coveted and is generally redistributional. In all of its various forms, of course, economic populism stands in opposition to free market capitalism. But this stance is fundamentally wrong and is based on a misconception of capitalism. I and many others, both inside and outside the region, would argue that economic populists have a better chance of achieving their goals through more capitalism, not less. Where there has been success, where living standards for the majority have increased, more open markets and increased private ownership have played a crucial part. The best evidence that populism is primarily an emotional response and not one based on ideas is that populism does not seem to recede in the face of repeated failures. Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Peru have had multiple episodes of failed populist policies since the end of World War II. Yet new generations of leaders seemingly have not learned from history and continue to reach for populism's simplistic solutions. Arguably, in the process, they have made matters worse. I regret populist movements' disregard of previous economic failure in their struggle to articulate an answer to their current distress, but I am not surprised by it or by their rejection of free market capitalism. In fact, I confess, with no small sense of irony, that I have always been puzzled by the willingness of large and often poorly educated populations and their governmental representatives to adhere to the rules of market capitalism. Market capitalism is a broad abstraction that doesn't always conform to untutored views of the way economies work. I presume markets are accepted because of their long history of creating wealth. Nonetheless, as people often complain to me, I don't know how it works, and it always seems to teeter on the edge of chaos. That is not an altogether illogical feeling, but, as taught in Economics 101, when a market economy periodically veers off a seemingly stable path, competitive responses act to rebalance it. Since millions of transactions are involved in the rebalancing, the process is very difficult to grasp. The abstractions of the classroom can only hint at the dynamics that, for example, enabled the U.S. economy to stabilize and grow after the September 11th attacks. Economic populism imagines a more straightforward world, in which a conceptual framework seems a distraction from evident and pressing need. Its principles are simple. If there is unemployment, then the government should hire the unemployed. If money is tight and interest rates as a consequence are high, the government should put a cap on rates or print more money. If imported goods are threatening jobs, stop the imports. Why are such responses any less reasonable than supposing that if you want a car to start, you turn the ignition key? The answer is that in economies where millions of people work and trade every day, individual markets are so intertwined that if you cap an imbalance, you inadvertently trigger a series of other imbalances. If you put a price ceiling on gasoline, shortages emerge and long lines at filling stations develop, as became all too apparent to Americans in 1974. The beauty of a market system is that when it is functioning well, as it does almost all the time, it tends to create its own balance. The populist view is equivalent to single-entry bookkeeping. It scores only credits, such as the immediate benefit of lower gasoline prices. Economists, I trust, practice double-entry bookkeeping. Burdened by its dearth of meaningful economic policy specifics, populism, to attract a following, has to claim a moral justification. Accordingly, populist leaders must be charismatic and exhibit a take-charge aura, even an authoritarian competence. Many, perhaps most, such leaders have come out of the military. They do not effectively argue for the conceptual superiority of populism over free markets. They do not embrace Marx's intellectual formalism. Their economic message is simple rhetoric spiced with words like exploitation, justice, and land reform, not GDP or productivity. To peasants tilling the soil of others, redistribution of land is a cherished goal. Populist leaders never address the potential downside, which can be devastating. Robert Mugabe, president of Zimbabwe since 1987, promised and delivered to his followers the confiscated land of white settlers. But the new owners were not prepared for management of the land. Food production collapsed, necessitating large-scale importation. Taxable income fell sharply, requiring Mugabe to resort to printing money to finance his government. Hyperinflation, at this writing, is unraveling Zimbabwe's social compact. One of Africa's historically most successful economies is being destroyed. Hugo Chavez, who became Venezuela's president in 1999, is following Mugabe's example. He is ravishing and politicizing Venezuela's once proud oil industry, the second largest in the world a half century ago. The level of essential oil field maintenance declined sharply when he replaced most of the government-owned oil company's non-political technicians with cronies of his regime. That caused a permanent loss of several hundred thousand barrels a day of productive capacity. Venezuelan crude oil output dropped from an average of 3.2 million barrels a day in 2000 to 2.4 million barrels a day during the spring of 2007. Yet fortune has smiled on Chavez. His policies would have bankrupted most any other nation. But since he became president, world oil demand has engendered a near quadrupling of crude oil prices and has, at least for now, bailed him out. Counting its heavy crude oil, Venezuela may well have one of the largest petroleum reserves in the world. But oil in the ground is no more valuable than when it lay dormant for millennia, unless you can create an economy to extract it. That happened to Venezuela in 1914, the year Royal Dutch Shell brought the technology needed to develop its riches. A significant dilemma plagues Chavez in his political stance. Two-thirds of his country's oil revenue comes from oil shipped to the United States. It would be quite costly to Venezuela to wean itself from its major customer, because it largely produces a heavy sour crude that requires the capability of U.S. refineries. Diverting oil to Asia would be possible, but very costly. Higher prices, of course, would give Chavez room to absorb the extra costs. But by ratcheting up his buying of influence abroad and political support at home, he is gradually, but inexorably, tying his political future to the price of oil. He needs ever higher prices to prevail. Fortune may not smile on him forever. The world should be relieved that not all charismatic populists behave like Chavez and Mugabe when gaining office. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, a Brazilian populist with a large following, was elected president in 2002. In anticipation of his victory, Brazilian stock markets fell, inflation expectations rose, and much-intended foreign investment was withdrawn. But to the surprise of most, myself included, he has largely followed the sensible policies embodied in the Plano Real, which Cardoso, his predecessor, had introduced in taming Brazil's hyperinflation of the early 1990s. Economic populism makes large promises without considering how to finance them. Too often, delivering on the promises results in a fiscal revenue shortage and makes it impossible to borrow from the private sector or foreign investors. This almost always leads to desperate reliance on the central bank to serve as paymaster. Requiring a central bank to print money to increase government's purchasing power invariably ignites a hyperinflationary firestorm. The result through history has been toppled governments and severe threats to societal stability. This pattern characterized Brazil's inflation episode of 1994, Argentina's of 1989, Mexico's of the mid-1980s, and Chile's of the mid-1970s. The effects on their societies were devastating. As the well-regarded international economists Rüdiger Dornbusch and Sebastian Edwards established, at the end of every populist experiment, real wages are lower than they were at the beginning. Hyperinflation pops up periodically in developing nations. In fact, it is one of their defining tendencies. Can Latin America turn its back on economic populism? Over the past two decades, despite repeated failures of macroeconomic policy, or perhaps because of them, the major countries in the region have nurtured a coterie of economic technicians who certainly have the credentials to lead Latin America in a new direction. The list is studded with policymakers of exceptional talent, most of whom I have had the privilege of working with during some very difficult times in recent decades. Pedro Aspe, Guillermo Ortiz, José Ángel Gurría, and Francisco Gil Díaz in Mexico, Pedro Malan and Arminio Fraga Neto in Brazil, Domingo Cavallo in Argentina, and others. Most hold advanced degrees in economics from prestigious American universities. Some even went on to become heads of state, Ernesto Zedillo in Mexico and Fernando Henrique Cardoso in Brazil. Most instituted productive market-freeing reforms and policies in the face of deep populist resistance, policies that enhanced their economies. Latin America would be in far worse shape without these able practitioners, in my judgment. But the deep divide between the worldview of most of these policymakers and the societies they serve, which remain prone to economic populism, is stubbornly persistent. Latin America's tenuous hold on economic stability was brought into sharp focus in 2006 by the presidential election in Mexico, which has the region's second-largest economy. Despite much success since the foreign exchange crisis of late 1994 brought Mexico to the edge of default, a firebrand populist, André Manuel López Obrador, came within a hairbreadth of being elected president. Whether he would in office be more Lula than Chavez, I cannot guess. Can a society with deep economic populist roots change quickly? Individuals can and have. But can a developed economy's market structure, its laws, its practices, its culture, be imposed on a society bred on ancient antagonisms? Brazil's Plano Real suggests the possibilities. Since stabilizing in 1994, Brazil's inflation has been contained, except for a transitory price surge during its 40% exchange rate devaluation in late 2002. Its economy has performed well, and standards of living have risen. To be sure, the failure of the devaluation to spark more than a short-term eruption of inflation may be tied more to global disinflationary forces than to domestic policy, but the Brazilian economy seems to be working for the Brazilian people. The experience of Argentina, on the other hand, is more sobering. Its economy collapsed in 2002, as the decade-long constitutionally mandated one-to-one link of the Argentine peso to the U.S. dollar broke, with vast disruption to employment and standards of living. The story of the debacle is instructive as to how far reform-minded policymakers can go without the implicit support of the population for the necessary fundamental policies. A society's drive to meet current needs, for example, cannot be thwarted by the imposition of a financial straitjacket. The society must experience progress and trust its leaders before it is willing to invest for the longer term. This change of culture typically takes a very long time. Argentina was, in most respects, a European culture prior to World War I. A succession of failed economic programs and periods racked with inflation created economic instability. Argentina lost ground in international economic comparisons, especially during the autocratic regime of Juan Perón. Its culture was gradually but significantly changing. Even the post-Perón regime of the well-intentioned Raúl Alfonsín failed to stem the explosive inflation and stagnation of the heavily regulated Argentine economy. Finally, in 1991, the situation became so desperate that the newly elected president, Carlos Menem, who ironically ran under the banner of Perón, turned to his able finance minister, Domingo Cavallo, for help. With President Menem's backing, Cavallo tied the Argentine peso 1-to-1 to the American dollar. This extremely risky strategy could have blown apart within hours of implementation, but the